Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com. Today is Sunday, October 14th, 2007, and this is show number 116. Well, I'm recording this week's show early this week because in a few short hours, I will be on Victor Callejo's most excellent podcast called Typical Mac User. I'm giddy with excitement, and by the time you hear this, this show will already be out. I sure hope some of you got to participate in the live talk show event, and we got a chance to talk. It's kind of weird. I'm sort of talking in the future, but you're listening to this in the past. I'm so confused. Anyway, Victor is such a cool guy. He does Mac and PC podcasts simply for the love of the technology and the love of talking to interesting people like, well, moi. I know I'm going to have a blast. Go check out the show at typicalmacuser.com. Susan Gerhardt, creator of AtPotter, the podcatcher for the visually impaired at apotter.org, wrote in to thank me for talking about the Wall Street Journal article on the Target lawsuit and the accessibility barriers that Target has. She explained that she's using a screen reader more and more on more and more websites and is even more aware of the differences between accessibility and usability. She says that alt tags do help. That's those little text things you're supposed to type in whenever you put in an image so that screen readers have something to say. But many sites are so encrusted with links and product categories and stuff to wade through that it's still really hard to get to the content you're looking for. The article I talked about last week from the Journal cited Amazon as being one of the best for accessibility. She pointed out that while it's technically true, it's nearly unusable because of all the slop on the site being hard to wade through. I got to thinking about that, and I had an epiphany. Don't worry, it didn't hurt. Well, anyway, what occurred to me is that people are going out of their way to make websites that work well on mobile devices, notably the iPhone. If you've ever tried to navigate to a site like, just take your BlackBerry and go out to Costco.com, and then after you want to hang yourself, come back and think about this idea instead. What if she were to point her screen reader at those sites that are trying to make themselves useful for mobile devices? Maybe the screen readers wouldn't have to pile through all this garbage to get what you really wanted if you could just go to these mobile versions. So I went out and I hunted down the mobile version of Amazon's website, which is not easy to find. I sent her the link and asked her to test it with her screen reader. The Amazon mobile link is really long, like I said, so I've got that link in the show notes if you want to go see it. Here's what she wrote back after testing it on her screen reader. Oh, that Amazon page is so sweet and simple. Just like the early days of the web when no one knew how to build complicated web pages. I could easily view my account, get the list of books I wanted, and had only one ad link. Oh, I was so happy this worked for her. I'm thrilled that this might be a cure for some of the problems the visually impaired have with accessibility, because the industry is paying a lot more attention these days to mobile phone users than they are to the visually impaired. I suspect it's a numbers thing, which kind of makes sense. But if the mobile phone mania benefits the visually impaired, I guess we shouldn't complain, right? Well, I'd be curious to have a few more people test this concept out for me. I looked around for a comprehensive list of mobile-friendly sites. I found one called timestocomemobile.com, which looks pretty good. It has a lot of sites in it. In general, though, it'd probably be easier to start with a site you want, like Amazon, and then go look for the term mobile-friendly along with that site name, because that way you start with what you want, not start with a list and figure out if it is what you want. If you're working with a screen reader out there, let me know if this helps you, okay? Well, Susan also gave me a treat back in one of her emails. She introduced me to something really intriguing and time-wasting. Do you remember the story of the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon? Back in 1994, a news group post stated that Kevin Bacon is the center of the universe. They started a trivia game in which you were supposed to find a link between any actor and Kevin Bacon going through no more than 6 people to link the two up. It's surprisingly easy to get to Kevin Bacon in a very few number of steps. Anyway, Susan told me that the University of Virginia Computer Science Department wrote a computer program called the Oracle of Bacon. It uses the Internet Movie Database as the database, and then they wrote a program to figure out the Bacon number of any actor's name you enter. Let me give you an example. I asked the Oracle of Bacon to check Leonard Nimoy. It came back instantly with a Bacon number of 2. 2? That's crazy. What would Leonard Nimoy ever have to do with Kevin Bacon? What turns out, Nimoy was in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country in 1991 with Christian Slater. Christian Slater was in Murder in the First in 1995 with Kevin Bacon. Get it? How cool is that? My problem is that I'm trying to find someone with a Bacon number above 2. I did search, and if you go back far enough, like into the silent movies, you can find a couple people. I think Buster Keaton and somebody else was a Bacon number of 3. If anybody can find a 4, I'd be really surprised. Even my cousin Alex, who's only been in like 5 movies and TV shows, he had a Bacon number of 3. So trying to find somebody above 2 is pretty tricky. I told my friend Galen about the Oracle of Bacon, and about 2 hours later, I got an email in which he said, "Why did you send me this? I've just been spending my whole afternoon doing it now. Even the dog Benji is a Bacon number of 2. Anyway, why don't you go off and waste some of your valuable time by playing with the Oracle of Bacon? It's at oracleofbacon.org. Last Saturday night, Kyle and I were waiting in line at a fast food restaurant, and he was getting bored. So he started playing with the emergency brake just to irritate me. Yes, it's delightful having a teenage boy around. I just think it's great. Anyway, he asked me, how does the emergency brake work? Well, I told him that from what I understand, the normal brakes are hydraulic, meaning they work on a fluid basis. Hydraulic fluid is incompressible. So if you have a pipe or a tube filled with fluid and you push on one end of it, then the other end must move by the same amount. So I explained that patiently and then said that I figured that the emergency brake must work on a cable or something like that in case there's a leak in the hydraulic fluid line, rendering the normal brakes useless. And he says, "Yeah, but how?" And I said, "It's a cable. I don't know." And that was the answer he really wanted. Mom's an idiot. Anyway, I sent this whole discussion over to Honda Bob, my most outstanding mechanic, and here's what he said. On most new Hondas and Acuras, the emergency brake is a drum brake inside the rear brake rotor. It is indeed operated by a cable. See, Mom was right. And the cable is attached to the brake lever, completely independent of the brake fluid. In other words, if you completely run out of brake fluid, for example, hose brakes or a line ruptures, the emergency brakes will stop the car. It has a one-way lever ratchet so that it can be depressed permanently. Only by some other action, pushing on it or pulling up on it, can it be released. In the case of a brake failure, you push or pull on the emergency brake lever slowly to stop the car. Engaging the emergency brake fully at high speed could cause a loss of control by locking up the rear brakes. The ABS does not function with the emergency brake. So, tell Kyle to keep his hands off the brake lever while driving. Better yet, strap him into the back seat. See, that's what I love about Honda Bob. Not only do you get these wonderful instructions and information about your car, you get child rearing techniques as well. Well, if you'd like to get answers to your automotive questions, head on over to hdabob.com and enter a question of your own. If you'd like a most outstanding mechanic to drive to your house in the LA or Orange County area to work on your Honda or Acura car, send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. or give him a call at 562-531-2321. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Martin Hauser is a listener in Germany who I've mentioned several times because he's been a godsend to me in my video encoding adventures. Just last week, he gave me a tip that just broke open what I was doing and helped me actually finish what I've been trying to do for about 6 weeks. Martin explained to me in his email that he's a bit of a paranoid and has always loved the application Little Snitch from Objective Development at obdev.at. Little Snitch tells you when a program tries to send info to the internet so that you can see what's going on in the background. He enjoys the power it gives him over what applications are allowed to send his data out. He was very excited when the new version 2.0 Beta 8 came out because it includes a network monitor which you can keep as a floating bezel window somewhere or have blend in whenever there is a network activity. He was so excited about this product that he did an audio review for us. I hope you enjoy his review.
Hello, Allison. This is Martin from the Bavarian Outback is a small review for your NutellaCast. I'm going to talk about Little Snitch from Objective Development, which can be found at www.obdev.at. Little Snitch is a program which uses the built-in Mac OS X firewall to filter outgoing connections based on program, destination host, and port. A set of rules allows you to fine-tune which application is allowed to connect to where, effectively filtering unwanted connections by unwanted software. If a program tries to connect to somewhere on the net, and this connection is not matched by any of your previous rules, it will pop up a little window, which gives you the opportunity to select if the program should be granted access to the net, and how long you want to grant this right. You can choose to allow access till the application quits, only once, or forever. Also, the criteria on which the new rule you are creating will match the connections the program makers can be chosen. Little Snitch is a nifty tool for the more paranoid amongst us. Recently, Objective Development has opened up its beta program for Little Snitch 2.0. Version 2 adds a number of improvements and some handy new features. The rule creation pop-up has been improved, and the rule configuration window itself has been migrated from a preference pane to a real program. Furthermore, a network monitor has been added by version 2.0, which allows you to see which programs are currently accessing the net, sorted by recent activity. The bezel window drawn for the network monitor also allows you to see which IP address the program connected to, and gives you the opportunity to hide certain programs from the monitor. The finished version of Little Snitch, version 2.0, will cost $29.95. Recent version 1.0 keys can be used to activate version 2.02. Upgrades from version 1.0 cost $12.95, and of course multi-seed packages are available. In conclusion, if you are somewhat paranoid on what your applications do on the net, then Little Snitch is the program for you. This sums up my review for the NutellaCast. Have a good time, thanks, and bye.
Thanks, Martin. I don't happen to be in the paranoid persuasion category, but luckily for Objective Development, I think I'm in the minority on that one. A lot of people like Little Snitch. I really appreciate you taking the time to record this review. I know how hard it is. And I really appreciate all the work you've been doing to help me with my video encoding. I really can't thank you enough. Sometimes you just gotta check out some software because it's from a company that has made other really cool stuff. Well, a great program is Audio Hijack Pro. It's awesome for recording audio on your Mac. You can't believe how many applications you'll find for it once you check it out. I reviewed it in detail back on show number 104, and I loved it. I use it all the time. Audio Hijack Pro is from Rogue Amoeba, so when you suggested that you'd like me to review some new software from them, I said, sure, right away. This review took a significant turn partway through, but it has a good plotline, I assure you. Rogue Amoeba's latest offering is called Radio Shift. Radio Shift is billed as being like a personal video recorder, a PVR for radio. Specifically, Radio Shift enables internet and AM/FM radio to be recorded automatically and listened to at any time. They point out that there's over 50,000 internet radio stations around the world. They also point out that with Radio Shift, you'll be able to listen to real audio, Windows Media, QuickTime, and MP3 streams all in one player. That alone sounded amazing. Well, they claim that Radio Shift Player removes us from the hassle of worrying about what format the audio is in. Their radio guide gives access to the 50,000 streams, and with a single click, it's supposed to allow you to subscribe to the content you want, recording it in the background, ready for when you want it. Radio Shift is $32 US, but they have a trial version that should help you make a decision for yourself whether you want to buy it. I had a feeling Radio Shift would perform as promised, because of their proven track record in recording audio. But I decided not to go on blind faith and give it a spin. When Radio Shift first launches, a window pops up recommending watching a short introductory movie. Well, at least they didn't ask me to read a manual, so I thought I could spare a moment or two for a video that would help me understand how this thing is supposed to work. I watched the video and I got the basic idea. Unfortunately, as I worked through the software, I ran into many difficulties. Because Rogue Amoeba has such a great reputation, I decided to send them my review as it was written late last week, which was not exactly flattering, and asked them to give me feedback before I went live with it. Almost immediately, I got a response from Paul, and he worked through each of my issues, gave me explanations and suggestions, but probably the most important thing he told me was that version 1.0, which I was reviewing, did have some issues, and perhaps I should work with version 1.0.2. So, that's exactly what I did. First, let me give you a bit of the flavor of the problems I found in my original review. The biggest problem was that I kept getting errors when I tried all different things. For example, I started with their map view, where you can click on a city, if there's a little flag there, and see the radio stations that are streaming from there. I clicked on Detroit, where I was born, and then on one of the stations, and I got an NS invalid argument exception fault error. Well, that was weird. I tried to play David Lawrence's radio show, and I got the error, "This is not a movie file." I tried to record Leo's Tech Guy show, and while the controls to do the recording looked good, I got some other kind of error, and it didn't record. I tried to play a certain jazz station, and I was told I'd have to download RealPlayer to get it to play. I tried the radio guide, and I was rewarded with a fourth, or is that fifth, error by that time. You can imagine how annoyed I was. Well, I sent all these off to Paul, and here's what I learned. The most important thing to realize is that streaming radio has a lot of issues with it. The formats are not the same, the radio stations are flaky, may or may not have their streams up at all. There's all kinds of things that are hinky about streaming radio in the first place. The good thing is that if you're interested in Radio Shift, you're probably already into streaming radio, and you know how hinky it is. I came into it blind, thinking, wow, this is a completely robust system. Well, Paul explained that when these players foul up, as seen by me in multiple cases, we often get errors that are not terribly helpful. But for the vast majority of streams, they work quite well. He didn't have a great answer for why I wasn't able to record David Lawrence, but did explain that they get the radio guide from a service called radiotime.com, and perhaps the error given had something to do on their end. One of the things that had bothered me was that time when I played the jazz station and was told I needed RealPlayer. I explained to Paul that it would have made me a happier customer if the language on the website had been, well, I don't want to say misleading, but it implied that I wouldn't have to do any work to get these different formats to play. Saying that Real Audio would play in one player led me to believe that I wouldn't have to download any other player. He explained that you do need all of the players installed, you just don't have to launch them to play your files in Radio Shift. We discussed different ways they could phrase this section on their website to keep a positive spin and yet not lead people astray in their assumptions. I really liked the dialogue with Paul because he was open-minded. He made me feel like it delighted him to get the opportunity to dissect the problems I was having. He wrote back at least a half a dozen times with more ideas of what we could do together. This is the huge difference between massive commercial programs run by corporations and working with shareware developers. I mean, this guy was so accessible, so open, so interested in making his product the best it can be. Tell me, have you ever had that experience with a big company? Yeah, call Apple on the phone sometime, or Microsoft. Ain't gonna happen. I love shareware developers. So today, if you've got a piece of software you're using that's a piece of shareware, and you haven't paid your shareware fee, write that check, would you? These guys earn that money every day and deserve our respect in paying them. Well, let me get back to Radio Shift after that commercial interruption. Remember, one of my problems was I thought I had recorded Leo Laporte's The Tech Guy show, but I couldn't find the recordings anywhere. Well, he told me where I could find them. It turned out it had recorded the show. Radio Shift puts your recordings into a music folder in a subfolder called Radio Shift. He also explained that you really don't need to know that. You'll be able to see your recordings right on Radio Shift. Sure enough, I checked this week, and I had a recording of Leo's radio show coming up in my Radio Shift window. It played beautifully in Radio Shift. I don't know what I was missing before, but it wasn't Radio Shift's fault. Sounds like an operator error to me. Well, this week when Rogue Amoeba came out with version 1.0.2, which Paul had told me fixed up some of the issues people were having, I went ahead and loaded it right up. The first thing I was delighted by was the fact that my recording was still in there, Leo's show, so the upgrade worked seamlessly. The second thing I noticed was a pop-up with a cool feature. It offered to enable auto-wake and power on. This feature allows your computer to actually be turned on by radio shift. How cool is that? I'm a little afraid to try it, but it would be an experiment for science, so maybe I should. We'll see. I'll have to find something to record in the middle of the night at some point. It'll probably wake up and scare me half to death, though. Well, anyway, once you have a recording in Radio Shift, you have four choices of what to do with it. You can simply play it right there. You can send it to iTunes, which is cool because then you could put it into your MP3 player. You could throw it away. Or get this, you can edit the audio. The icon for editing is a kind of a mutation of the Audacity icon. And just as I suspected, clicking it launches Audacity and imports the file for editing. Again, I would assume that you probably have to have Audacity on your machine before it's going to do that. I really like that feature. You can picture just wanting to clip out a bit and send to someone or slicing out commercials. Makes me wonder if you could look at the waveform in Audacity to be able to just tell when it's not Leo talking and it's a commercial. That would be cool. Well, I also decided to try a few things that had failed before. I clicked on the World button and looked around for some stations. Some failed, just like they did before, but now that I know that the radio stations are just flaky, I kept poking around a little more, and a lot of them came through just fine. The sound quality is a limiter, of course. Listening to music from Port-au-Prince was fun, but the audio was a little bit rough. I still ran into a lot of hinkiness. Again, I think it's a product of the streaming radio issues. I wasn't able to play the LA Philharmonic, KCLA, or even KABC, which are really big channels in Los Angeles. They all got Mac OS error -2048. However, I was able to listen to a radio station from Ponta Delgada, which is an island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. All right, so maybe it's not in the middle, but it's in the Azores, which is way the heck out there. Their audio was good, and the music was even kind of interesting. Well, that got me going, looking for more obscure places to listen to. I found a radio station in Reykjavik, the capital of Iceland. And of course, they were playing American music. Jeez. Well, anyway, I finally had to stop myself. I tell you, this Radio Shift thing is addictive. Radio Shift, again, is $32 US, and it's a universal binary, which means we can play our recordings not only on the newer Intel boxes, but also on our PowerPC machines. If you're addicted to internet radio, or even if you just have one show you can't live without, but you tend to miss, you might really like Radio Shift from RogueAmoeba.com. I'm so excited to get the Wall Street Journal as an advertiser. It's so easy to do an ad for something you really believe in. Let's take a couple of articles I found this week in the journal as an example. Well, first of all, the marketplace section rocks. That's where all the good tech stuff is. Sometimes you find stuff that's maybe not even in the field you're normally interested in, but it's still crazy interesting. Well, the left column of the first page of the marketplace is almost always interesting. For example, this week, Sarmad Ali wrote an article about how to use Instant Messenger at work, even if your company blocks that protocol through their firewall. He reviews two services, Mebo and Cool IM, and he tested them both on Windows and Mac. These are web-based Instant Messenger clients, and they allow you to launch AIM, ICQ, MSN Messenger, and more, all at the same time in a browser window. Well, how about this article? Christopher Rhodes wrote a fascinating article about how ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, has finally decided to allow non-Roman language domains. This is a problem I'd never thought about before. He titled his article, "What's the Hindi Word for .com?" Well, that really kind of points out that if your language doesn't have Roman characters, you're really at a disadvantage on the web. How do you even name your domain? Well, there's a fair amount of controversy over the fact that ICANN, who is in charge of all the domain names, is actually a U.S. organization. And there's concern that a U.S.-centric view isn't serving the world properly. So this move by ICANN is probably a very necessary step towards keeping confidence up. Articles like this are why I love the Wall Street Journal and have actually canceled all my other newspaper subscriptions. I just love to curl up with the Journal every morning and read what's going on in technology in the world. Well, if you'd like to get access to that, the best newspaper I know of, either in handy and portable paper form or that newfangled web-based version, click on the ad for the Wall Street Journal on podfeed.com and subscribe. Bart Bouchatz from bartbouchatz.ie is the first on his block in Ireland to get the new iPod Touch. I haven't talked to anyone before in real life who has one yet, so let's hear what Bart has to say about it.
Hi folks, this is Bart from bartbouchatz.ie back for another review on the Nocilla Cast. I think this review is going to be a first for me because I honestly don't think I've ever talked about hardware before. Also, this review comes with a slight apology to our American listeners because, really, this is all old news for you. But trust me, for us over here in Ireland, this is a big deal. This is real news. What am I talking about? Well, the iPod Touch arrived in Ireland this week, and I got mine a few days ago. I think it's important we put this into context. There is no iPhone over here. There is no word of when there will be an iPhone over here, so as far as I'm concerned, the iPhone may never make it over here. We're a very small country here in Ireland. I really can't imagine we're very high up on Apple's list of people to go negotiate with. So the chances are we're not going to see an iPhone for a very long time. So, for us, the iPod Touch is Apple's touch technology, and it is as close as we're going to get to it, unless we fork out 30 grand for Microsoft's giant big table. The reality is, I absolutely positively love this device. This is a revolution I'm holding in my hands. To me, this is every bit as big as when Apple first brought the GUI to the mass market. This is the future, and I think it's absolutely fantastic. I can't wait for the day when all of my handheld devices operate in this way. You know, have them be all screen and just have the controls be on the screen and changing. It is like the mouse and the GUI coming to the handheld device. No, I honestly can't speak highly enough of the fact that I think this really is a genuine revolution in interface design. Now, we've all heard about just how fantastically great all this stuff is, and there's not really much point in my wasting the rest of your time just re-going over just about how absolutely fantastic this device is. So instead, I'm going to concentrate on the ways in which it is not so fantastic. It is revolutionary, I absolutely love it to bits, but it's not perfect, and a lot of those imperfections can be fixed with software updates, some of them can't. And so I want to concentrate on what's not so good about the device, so that if you're thinking of buying one, that you know that on the one side you have its revolutionary nature and the fact that it is an absolute joy to interact with devices in this way, and on the other side you'll have a list of some of the not so good points about the iPod Touch, and I'm assuming a lot of these would also apply to the iPhone. Actually, the first point I absolutely want to make clear to people is that the iPod Touch is not the iPhone Lite. This is not an iPhone with the phone taken out. This is an iPod. This comes as a big disappointment to a lot of people, but this isn't trying to be an iPhone without the phone. This is trying to be an iPod, and it's a very, very good iPod. But bear in mind, it means that it comes with less than the iPhone, and I'm not just talking about the phone part. You have read-only access to your calendar rather than actual access to your calendar. You have read-only access to your contacts rather than actual access to your contacts. And you're also missing an awful lot of the other applications. The home screen on the iPod Touch has a total of 7 icons, so there's an awful lot of blank space. In case you're wondering, those 7 icons are Safari, YouTube, Calendar, Contacts, Clock, Calculator, and Settings. Everything else that's on the home screen of the iPhone is not on the iPod Touch. And really, the iPod Touch isn't trying to be an iPhone, it's trying to be an iPod. It does very well at being an iPod, but you just have to have that, you know, you have to bear in mind that this is not an iPhone. This is an iPod. So, I'm going to start by listing off the things which Apple cannot fix simply with a software update. These are sort of hardware issues I have with the device. The first one, and it's not really Apple's fault at all, really, it's the fault of Flash technology, in my opinion, is that the damn thing is so insanely slow to synchronize compared to a hard disk-based iPod. Honestly, I think it took as long to sync up 16 gigs onto my iPod Touch than it did to sync up 60 gigs onto my regular old iPod Photo. Now, hard disks are faster than flash, it's as simple as that, and 16 gigs of flash is an awful lot of flash, so it takes an awful long time to sync. The next thing I had a little bit of trouble with is that if you hold the iPod Touch at too flat of an angle, it doesn't do that cool changing aspect ratio thing. Because, of course, when you think about the logistics of it, if you're holding it almost flat, then how on earth can it tell the difference based on gravity as to which way around it's pointing? It makes sense, but it's just something to bear in mind. apparently I obviously naturally hold the thing too low down. If I held it higher up, I wouldn't have this problem, but, you know, it's just something that affects me. It took me a little while to figure out why it wasn't doing it well. As soon as I held it at a steeper angle, it started working absolutely perfectly. So, probably just more something to bear in mind rather than an actual shortcoming of the device. Then the last sort of hardware-y thing is the fact that these iPods, like the iPhones, are not compatible with an awful lot of the old iPod accessories. I have a fairly recently purchased iPod speaker system in the kitchen. You know, the iPod Touch does sit into it, it does charge, and the sound does come out of the speakers. However, the only thing on the remote control that actually works is the volume. You can't play, pause, skip, etc. You have to actually walk over to the iPod and use the touchscreen to control it, even while it's in the speaker system. This is actually, to be honest with you, this is quite a bit of an annoyance to me because I use that system in the kitchen all the time. I'm always listening to stuff on my iPod while I'm cooking, and now I have to walk over to the iPod to pause, play, stop, whatever. The next thing I want to talk about is how the iPod Touch deals with photographs. Now, maybe I'm a bit of a freak here. The chances are this isn't a big deal to most people. But to me, I was really, really looking forward to having my photographs on the Touch and being able to flick through them like Steve Jobs did on the keynote and stuff. So I was a little disappointed that it's good. In fact, it's very good and it's still bloody enjoyable. But it's not as good as I think it could be and indeed should be. So I have two issues with it. The first is the way in which it actually synchronizes the songs to the iPod, and I presume it's the same for the iPhone. So you would think, or at least I thought, that what it would simply do is it would copy the photographs from your iPhoto library straight over to your iPod, but it doesn't. What it actually does is it recreates a new copy of each and every photograph you sync, it stores that new copy onto the hard drive of the machine you're syncing from, and then it syncs those copies to your iPod or your iPhone. And those copies are a low-resolution version of your image. And they still take up quite a bit of space, actually. It was quite a few hundred megs of space were taken up when these low-res versions were created. So this has three effects. Two bad, one good. The good effect is it saves space on your iPod Touch, which, you know, if you have the 8GB version, that's really important. With the 16GB version, it's still bloody important. But I'm afraid the two downsides are that the images are physically smaller, so the cool pinching to zoom thing doesn't actually let you zoom very far because the images are not significantly bigger than they can be displayed on your iPod Touch, which I think is a bit silly, really, because the zooming is so bloody cool. The other negative effect, of course, is the waste of your disk space. And really, the waste of your disk space is avoidable because it could resize them on the fly as it was syncing rather than actually permanently saving the resized copy in your iPhoto library. But anyhow, I suppose these aren't really showstoppers. They're, you know, it's still dead bloody cool to play with your photographs, but really, come on, Apple, you can do better than that. Then, final thing that I find an absolute shocker is the fact that the iPod Touch does not support events. Events are what is so bloody cool about the new iPhoto, and they're simply not supported. So with events, you don't make separate albums for all of your different things. Events happen automatically, they just work out perfectly, they make it very easy to keep your photographs organized, you sync them over to your iPod, and events don't make it over as albums, so all your photographs are in a great big blob, and it's almost impossible to find the one you want. Really, that has to be fixed in the next software update. The next thing I want to talk about is the actual, you know, iPod features of the iPod Touch, because let's face it, it's an iPod first after all. I have just two quarrels really with its iPod-y features. The first one is absolutely unbelievably silly and bloody annoying. If you have particularly long song titles on every other iPod I've ever owned, as soon as you select them in the menu, it begins to scroll across, which means you get to read every bit of the song's name, no matter how long it is. The iPod Touch does not do that. Even in the now playing screen, the original iPod would scroll the title so you could see the entire thing. The iPod Touch does not do that. So if you have a long song title, you simply cannot physically, anyway that I've been able to discover, see the end of the song title. This really annoyed me because I have a couple of audiobooks which are in 9 and 10 parts, and they happen to have a long title, so I can't see what part is what. So I have to actually go to the top and start counting. 1, 2, 3, 4. Here's part 6, which is where I had happened to have left off. That, to me, is very, very silly. It just looks like an oversight on Apple's part, and they really do need to address that in the next software update. Then the next thing that annoyed me about the iPod features is probably something that really only affects a few freaks like me, but I used to use the sleep timer on my old iPod Photo all the time. So I go to bed with my iPod playing, in fact, it was playing Stephen Fry reading the Harry Potter books, and I'd set it to 15 minutes of sleep, and then off I'd go to sleep, and the iPod would turn itself off 15 minutes later. Maybe it exists on the iPod Touch, but if it does, I have not been able to find it, so it may as well not exist. Lastly, I just want to finish up on a slightly more positive note, and I want to yet again put another two nails into the coffin of the iPhone haters, because they always seem to trump up the same two things. oh, the screen will just get covered in fingerprints, and oh, you could never possibly type on a screen. Wrong, and very wrong. I had the keyboard literally a couple of minutes, and already I found it easier than typing on a BlackBerry. I've never actually owned a BlackBerry, I have to say, but I have used my father's one on occasion, and I absolutely positively hated typing on it. Honestly, I took to typing on this touchscreen thing like a duck to water. The first thing I did with it was enter the web key into my network, and actually, bad points here to Apple, it starred out. Now, my web key is properly secure, it's 64 characters long, and all I got was dot, 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 dot on the screen. It took me quite a few goes to get my web key in. So really, Apple, you should have given me an option to see it in plain text like you do in OS X. Anyway, that's beside the point. After re-entering my web key a few times, sorry, WPA key, I don't dare use web, it's horrible and insecure. The first thing I did with the keyboard was log into WordPress through Safari and write a post from the iPod Touch. Worked like a charm, the auto-correction is fantastic. I don't see a problem with the keyboard, I think it's absolutely fine. It's definitely fine for an iPod, and I honestly wouldn't see a problem using it on my phone either. I just think it works, and I don't see what the fuss is about. As for the fingerprints on the screen, this is bizarre, because, yeah, the screen gets absolutely covered in fingerprints in absolutely no time at all, especially while you're playing with your photographs and pinching and zooming and stuff, you know, great fun. And you'd imagine that this would make the screen unusable. I don't know how Apple do it, but you see straight through the fingerprints. As long as the iPod Touch is on, you don't see them. I don't understand how it works. It's black magic to me. But it does work. As soon as you turn it off and you put the thing at an oblique angle, it's like, oh my god, the screen's filthy. But as soon as you turn it on, you don't see the fingerprints, and you work away with it, and everything's fine. So I guess it just works. I've no idea how, but it just does. So those two issues that people are always beating the iPhone over the head with, usually by people who've never actually owned one of the devices, I don't see them as problems. Basically, in summary, I think this is a fantastic device. It's highly revolutionary. It is not perfect, and I've outlined literally all of the quips I have with it in this recording, so there is no other annoyances to the device as far as I'm concerned. Every little thing about it that annoys me, I've told you about. And really, it wasn't that many, and none of them were actually showstoppers. So they don't, to me, they don't spoil the really great device. The price tag spoiled it a little. It's bloody expensive, really. But, you know, the iPhone, now that it's come down in price, is much better value than the iPod Touch now. Anyway, this is a revolution, and I'm dead happy with it. Oh, would you look at that? I've been prattling on for nearly 12 minutes. Honestly, I think this is my longest ever review. Apologies to those of you who don't think any of this is news. Anyway, I'm going to leave it at this, so until next time, happy computing.
Thanks, Bart. Really appreciate your review. I really like Bart's reviews because he's not just a fanboy. You know, he's willing to talk about the things he loves and what bugs him. So it comes off more realistic, I think, than these people who just love, love, love something. I do agree with him. So many people think the iPod Touch is an iPhone without a phone. But if you look at it that way, man, you're going to be completely disappointed. It turns out what it is a really cool iPod. Had they come out with it first, I think people would have understood it better. I could debate with him, though, about how well the touch keyboard works. I'm pretty good at it with one finger, but in portrait mode doing an email, I cannot do two thumbs. It's a disaster. I really, really wanted to like the touch screen, but I'm afraid if you only measure it on accuracy of typing, I'm still way better on a BlackBerry. I think the trade-off in usability is worth it, though, to have it disappear when I want the screen space for a video or a web page. But I do expect enhancements to that interface. It could still be better. I do find that if you simply trust it, like Steve Jobs says, it does actually work pretty well with one finger. Remember that my 17-year-old son Kyle thinks that I'm the biggest dork who ever walked the planet, right? Well, I'm sure that comes as a shock to all of you parents out there. I'm sure your children think that you're brilliant still. Well, since I'm a dork, everything I do must also be dorkish. Since my podcast is near and dear to my heart, that must make it the dorkiest thing there is. That's why I about had a heart attack this week when he IM'd me to tell me to come up and see a cool new application he found. And yes, we use Instant Messenger to communicate in the middle of the day at our house. Well, being a good student of the No Silicast, he started with a problem statement. He held up his English paper and he said, I have to memorize all these words for my English class with their definitions. I thought about making flashcards like I always do, and then I figured there must be a program out there that will make flashcards for me. I should point out that as any good teenager, He's very lazy, so it's a good driver to find innovative solutions. Or at least that's what he leads me to believe. Well, you really have to keep in mind how skeptical my son is. He hates everything. He flips on this program he found called iFlash from loopware.com, and he's already entered about 30 words he has to know into it, and he excitedly starts showing me how cool it is. I figured I'd better check this out just to see it's as good as he says. You know, he's such a fanboy. Not. All right, so I downloaded iFlash to give it a try. When it first comes up, your first option is to create a new deck. Obvious enough. Then you're taken to a screen with a big new icon with a plus sign on it. Even I could figure out that it meant to add a new card. You could delete cards from this window too, but I just got attached to the ones I made, so I don't want to get rid of them yet. When you create a new card, you simply enter the front side wording, then hit a tab and type in the back side. Well, wait a minute though, what if you're taking an art class and you have to identify a picture, not a word? No problem at all. iFlash has an image button which lets you drag an image onto the front or the back side. I went to Creative Commons and searched on Monet and found a nice image. Didn't even have to download it to my disk because iFlash let me drag directly from a browser window. That's a really nice interface. Okay, so I built a few new cards, got a neato image in one of them. Now what do? Easy enough, there's a study button. You can just hit study again when the next window comes up, or you can tailor your study session. Let's say you've been working on all the adverbs, and you're doing pretty well on those, but those darn gerunds are really throwing you for a loop. You can select just those cards that are giving you trouble and only study those. Or you can limit the number of cards so that you can swallow the information in bite-sized chunks. Or you can jump right in and study them all. As you flip through the slides, you can click a button that says Known, so you can make sure the next time you only work on the ones you didn't know. The graphics are really slick. The words slide quickly in all different directions to keep it interesting. I particularly liked how the Monet picture cards came up in their own window, so you'd be able to spend time looking at the graphic. The developer, David McGavern, or Davey as he appears to like to be called, definitely gets what our biggest problem is. One of the options during your study session is to hit a display button that makes the entire screen go black so you can only see your study session of your cards. Gone are your chat windows, Facebook, email. You can force yourself to pay attention. He even realized that as you're doing your studying, you realize that you botched one of the cards up, misspelling a word or maybe saying that Pope John IV was actually on Star Trek The Next Generation. He gave us a little pencil icon so we can edit the card right while you're in the middle of flipping through the slides. As much as I hate to admit it, Kyle has found a really sweet application that solves one problem and solves it really well. That is the highest praise we can give a shareware developer in my world. For $15 US, you can make studying more fun. Isn't that worth the price? Check it out at loopware.com. I paid that shareware fee even before I started playing with the software, just on Kyle's recommendation alone. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this fun-filled episode of the new Silicast. Please be sure to keep those emails coming to allison@podfeet.com or put a comment on the blog. We're getting lots of great feedback there now, too. Be sure to listen to the Typical Mac User show, too. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.